out of all of your gear, do you own any gear that has any heritage, like that was used by anyone?
Yeah, we were using a very, very interesting instrument for nearly 2 years.
Well, I'm going to ask about the Moog. I know if that's what you're talking
actually,
about.
Yeah, actually the Moog.
But I'm wondering if you actually own anything yourself, or you've gone out of your way to find or purchase anything.
Well, we have some gear that was used by other people, of course. Like, I have an Oberheim Expander, which was used by Laszlo Benker. He was one of the top studio players in Munich and Europe, let's say, in the 80s. This synthesizer is on numerous records, from like Jermaine Jackson to Engelbert Humperdinck. and you know, really. So this is sometimes funny when this is like the Oberheim Expander. Then I have a MXR pitch transposer, which was located at a studio in Munich here. There were recordings of Queen and Led Zeppelin there. So I have a good chance that this piece of equipment was used on some of the recordings. But, you know, Munich is a very tiny city, let's say. So everybody knows everybody from the scene. So it's like with synthesizers, they changed the owner, and the pre-owner was doing a lot of stuff with it.
And I think we are musicians. We don't pay double price because somebody played with it.
Yeah,
somebody else is doing this. We just want to have a good instrument. We love the heritage, yes, but we don't pay double prices for.
No, actually,
you're not Daniel Miller buying a Kraftwerk
Yeah, Slow Coder. Daniel Miller, we know him. He can do that.
He can do that. Yes, Daniel can do that.
We had a gig in Berlin at the Super Booth, and Daniel Miller was playing before us. Was very nice for us to meet him. Yeah.
No, sometimes we get instruments for free because the older studio guys don't use them anymore. Mm. So it was with the Oberheim Expander.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was with the Moog synthesizer we were using for 2 years.
And Dieter Döpfer showed us some instruments he made for Kraftwerk himself.
Yes.
He's a friend of us, and he's located in Munich. And this is very interesting for us.
Also with Dieter Döpfer, he made a lot of things for us that it was possible for us to tour, actually. When we started with Ströbe, we were very much into like the DJ thing. You know, they thought we're DJs and we're coming with a USB stick and everybody's set up. Everything's set up, but it wasn't. So they told us we have about 5 minutes of setup time with like 50 or 60 cross patchings. It was, so I asked Dieter, I said, there's a way we can overcome this. So with a multi-core we do. So, and he made it like 2 weeks later, we were able to go on tour. So this is like Munich.
In the late 90s, I did a live electronic show, and I was terrified of using even MIDI. I refused to even use MIDI. I was just completely terrified.
Really?
What I ended up doing is I put all my backing tracks, and I had different types of backing tracks on CDs. So I used CDJs, which was also nice because I could mix like a DJ. And then I had all my gear on either side of me. Ed would mix in the backing track, which was also on mixers, so I could filter and manipulate the backing tracks as well, and then would play the gear on top. But I was like, I was so scared of bringing MIDI out on the road.
What did you use? What kind of outboard equipment did you use?
A lot of pedals. I was very much into vintage effects pedals and running everything through those. I used, my main synthesizer was by Juno 106 that I,
oh, right,
bought,
okay,
that I bought in 87.
Good choice, by the way. Yes.
I had this crazy Roland thing. I can't even remember what it was called. I don't know if you remember this. It was like a Roland sampler, but it looked like a Roland version of an MPC. But the reason I used it is it had the light theremin. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It was the DJ 500 thing, Roland. There was one thing. And then, well, the other thing was the MZ303.
Yeah.
Which looked like a sampler.
Yeah, but this was so fun on live shows because one thing, and this is something we could talk about, one thing that was very important to me on my live show was I really wanted people to be able to connect with what I was actually doing to make sounds,
mm-hmm,
versus, say, a laptop live show where no one can see anything that's generating the sounds. You can't see the physical motion of I'm doing this with my hand or this with my hand. And so I really liked the light theremin on that because I would have it on a kind of a tape delay feedback setting.
Yeah, I know this instrument now.
Right. So I would trigger the sample and then have my hands would like, and do all that. And when people would talk to me after the show, everyone was like, what is that? What were you doing? Because they could see.
People react to like action on stage, definitely.
Yeah.
That's we always experienced.
But I imagine there's challenges with how you're doing.
Of course.
You know, knob-based gear, basically.
It's always like running on Indy 500, you know, on full speed with a car. Everything can break on your time trial, let's say. But it always, sometimes it leads us to different places where we didn't expect to be musical-wise. It's also interesting.
Before we started our collaboration together, we always also were live musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I played drums, Mario played e-bass, and this was the normal thing for us to be on the stage and doing, to play live without a net. We were thinking about, should we, before our first gig, I said, because I want to make the safe version, I said, mm-hmm. Hey, can we make a safe version, just a recording or something? Then Mario said, no, this shit, because we are live musicians. And that's because of that, we said, okay, no, we have to do it live. We tried it at first in very small locations and it always worked. Now we are building up and we have sometimes really on a big festivals, many thousand people, and we are just relying on this on the systems with so many patches and it's working.
Well, actually, yes. With one incident, we were touring Europe and we were traveling to Denmark.
We played the
change. I was losing one power supply, one of two power supplies, what means one side of my synthesizer, of my modular synthesizer, was completely gone.
But not between the show.
It was before the show.
Yeah, because of this off of trailing, because of trailing. And we never, it's really crazy because we have so much equipment, but we always could do our show.
We never had a big failure.
I don't know why. Because it's so many cables and so many stuff
but
going on.
We always really keen on having the equipment set up properly. I actually play four synthesizers on stage. I have four. I mean, one is the chord machine, but some last gig, you remember one melody synthesis was completely gone. Remember?
Yes.
It was completely gone, so I had to improvise. And it turned out that it was really cool. The people love acid house music, and we totally turned the Moog synthesizer into acid house. It was just a fucking square wave, you know, the people, not chords and nothing, just freak show stuff. That's what they like. And it would never happen if the melody synth would work, you know? So it's interesting.
How much improvisation do you feel is in your live show? Like how much can you change it from night to night?
It's always a mixture.
What we have are CDs and gates, means note informations and for specific melodies, for our songs, for the melodies. That's it. That is what we have. The oscillators are not tuned. We have to tune it. We have to make the sound on stage. We have to tune the oscillators and to make sound properly on stage because we only have the note informations. And the note information can be varied, of course.
And we don't have fixed arrangements. We don't have the whole songs. We could do that with the Circlon. Yeah, you could do that. But we don't do it because we are always playing part by part and we are looking at each other and, hey, let's play this part or that part or let's play it longer. So we don't have fixed song structures. We have some melodies or some parts, but never a fixed song. Every gig is a new one.
It's like one of the last shows we played. I explained it to one of the guys in the audience. I said, we try to play, let's say, with the audience, you know, with the room and with the audience.
Like a DJ.
Yes.
Or like a musician.
Because
we also played in a band together where we always played with the audience. When we played in big bands together, I played drums, he played bass, and then the band leaders saw, okay, the people are dancing now. Let's play it longer or let's play this again.
Right.
We always, like James Brown, we always did it on, okay.
But you have to admit, traditionally, when people think of like a band or live music, everyone says there is some feeding off the audience, but a lot of it is pretty set for most bands. I mean, I know what you're saying, but I feel like I was like a total punk rock kid and came from that background. Mm-hmm. And what I really liked about punk rock when I was a kid was the audience was part of the show, you know?
Yeah.
When punk rock got more commercial and I got a little older to where I could get in the clubs, I really enjoyed DJ culture in the early 90s. Cause for me, it was the same thing where it was like the DJ wasn't on the pedestal and everything was kind of influencing each other. And of course that got more commercial as well, where DJs were suddenly up, you know, two stories high on a riser. It's interesting to me how that sort of attitude seems to be kind of seeping back into live performance for a lot of people.
I think this is a really, really interesting thing because we're not facing the audience when we play live.
Right. So it's intuitive.
Yes, it's very intuitive. But we had many shows where it really felt like the audience gives us wings, so to say, mm-hmm. because the machines were running properly. No machine was making any weird things. So it was a creative process. When you give something to the machine and it comes back in a better way you expect it, and the audience likes it. To me, this is like the best thing I can imagine, you know?
Oh, it is.
like Toby said, we're very life-oriented musicians. We need this kind of adrenaline. I'm always nervous before a show, totally.
Because we also played in some pop bands and you are not nervous because everything is fixed, because you know what you have to do and
right.
It's your job and everything is okay.
In this case, you try to do your job also as yes, best as you can.
Of course. But I think when we are playing with this band, the people are always seeing they are part of a creative life process. Sometimes they saw, I noticed the song. It was this song, but at first I didn't realize it because it was different. And they are part of a creative process. And this is, very interesting for them too. And for us too. You know, this is the really interesting part.
Also, they see that we communicate on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I have to count in parts, or Toby has to count in a part. So the people really can see that we are counting in different parts that we can make a good transition to another song or something.
I also come from live music background. I was a guitarist before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, we can make a band together.
There we go. So I understand where you're coming from when you're talking about all this, which makes me wonder if you, or even if any of us had started with electronic music and started with this gear, do you think what you'd be doing would be, as far as playing live and playing out, do you feel like...
Murray started with electronics.
I started with electronics when I was very young. When I was 8 years old, I started with my first synthesizer when I was 11.
Mm-hmm.
I had my first drum machine when I was 9. And I was making money when I was 12.
Oh, wow.
I had a sequencer, I had a synthesizer, I had a drum machine. And I was playing pop 40 music for old people.
Altenheim.
Old people's home, you know. Retirement homes and some...
Yeah, I started with electronic too. The only reason I started playing guitar was because I was writing parts for a friend of mine who was a guitarist too. He couldn't he couldn't play them because they were too moving. The chords were too weird. So I'm like, well, I should write on guitar. But my first time I ever got paid playing music was filling in playing keyboard in a reggae band. So, which was super improvisational. Like the dude would turn around and yell chords at me at points. So almost like that sort of gave me a different perspective than, say, if I started like working on a laptop.
Yeah, I know. I got you.
Yeah.
To be honest, I asked myself the same. I started with, let's say, with Hammond organ. I added a drum machine. I added a synthesizer. I added a sequencer. So I was playing. And then when I was 14... I was changing over to electric bass because I did not feel the sound in my hands when I was playing synthesizer. Mm. You know, I wanted to have an instrument where I can shape the sound with my hands. So I got very much into Jaco Pastorius and Weather Report, these jazz rock bands. And I was like, I played everything I could get a hold on, you know. I was playing wedding bands. It was a very new experience for me to play an instrument where I can shape the sound with my hands. So that's why I was thinking that this is a real different thing to play a stringed instrument or a synthesizer. So much different.
Absolutely. What's the oldest piece of gear that you take on the road?
Sometimes we take a Mini Moog on the road, which is the 1977.
Yeah, so we are changing the equipment to take on the road sometimes. Yeah.
So in studio, we take whatever we have, actually, and whatever fits in a case. Sometimes it's on the live shows, yes.
Yeah, I also took my snare from the 1961 from Ludwig. Yeah, also sometimes.
That qualifies.
I have a very nice Chorus pedal, which is like the Boss CE1, like the big first Boss foot pedal Chorus, which is built also in 1977. But to be honest, I was switching over to modular gear because I didn't want to bring my vintage synthesizers on stage. Mm. So like 10 years ago when we started with La Prospanda, a band which is very famous here, I wanted to take a synthesizer on tour. And I didn't want to take the Overheim on tour or the Mini Moog. So I started checking out modular gear and found out that this is a real alternative to my old vintage gear.
Yes, we have many things we're using in the studio we don't have on tour. Like here are two tube techs just on the right. We don't take it on tour.
We have like a house here and there we are together with Nick McCarthy from Franz Ferdinand, an English band. Mm-hmm. And he came and he, you know, he moved in here with us. We have a lot of synthesizers here. It's Minimal, Jupiter 8, NARP. We have all Rolands. We have a TR-808. We have basically everything. I have an emulator too, which I love.
It really makes sense for us to have two big cases and you set it up and you can play.
Because we are moving back and forth to London where Nick has his studio. And so sometimes we take the Moog and then other synthesizers we take to London and stay there for about 10 days or 2 weeks and make recordings with the guys there. All the time we got some vintage gear over there. We got it home and it was broke. You know, it was broken. Like one voice board of the emulator was broken. So it's not so easy to repair an emulator too.
That's why I was curious. I was curious how risky you take things when you go on the road.
No, we are very happy to have a very, very good technician here on the fly who can repair basically everything.
Or two. Peter, Gerard, and the guy.
Yeah, so
we have good people here.
Yeah, we have one guy taking care of the Moog only. So he's a good friend of us and he has a company and he produces synthesizers, which are copies of the Moog system I use. Excellent. So he's very happy to get their hands on the original Moog synthesizer.
The album using all this vintage gear.
Yeah.
The album, on the other hand, doesn't have a nostalgic sound. It sounds very modern.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm wondering how, is that natural for you? Is that intentional?
Yes.
Is it difficult not to fall in a trap of making things sound vintage using this historical gear?
When we first got in touch with the old Moog from 69, we were very impressed when we got to Eberhard Schöner's house and were presented to the Moog and we could work there.
Well, let's go back on that. So this was... Mm-hmm. This was the 1969 Moog that was used by the Beatles and has a ton of history behind it.
Yeah.
And you said you somehow got access to it.
Yeah, we got to know Eberhard Schöner, Tobi's wife, is friends with some guys who know this and them. And so we got together in a way and we met Eberhard Schöner on a garden party.
Somebody tried to connect us and it was a good connection. He was like, these young guys. But then we sent him some videos of us and he checked, okay, that's cool.
I asked him when we left from the party, I asked Eberhard, can we just see the Moog synthesizer? We never saw a real, it's number 7 or something. We never saw a Moog synthesizer, which is that old. And he said, yes, come by. But it took about 2 or 3 weeks. And so we got there and we saw the system. We switched on, we played. And we got back and had a coffee. And then his wife, Steffi Schöner, who is an unbelievable film director,
She made the first video of
Kate Bush.
Kate Bush. Yeah. Really cool.
And Eberhard, they're living on an old farmhouse on 900 meters on a mountain. And so after 2 hours, they gave us the key for the house. And they said, we're not here for about a week. You can live here. You can use the fridge. It's full. And you can do as much Moog synthesizer as much as you want.
That's really crazy. Yeah.
We were driving home from that mountain. I was crying because this is what a lifelong dream with this machine. I knew this machine since I'm a kid. Let's say from Giorgio Moroder, I Feel Love, from all those TV series where Eberhard made the music, the kids series, he made the music for this series. I knew this synthesizer, the sound from this synthesizer.
This was really special. It's an old Bauernhaus.
A little farmhouse.
With a studio where also Sting was for 1 year in this, I don't know, 80s.
Sounds like a Connie Plank kind of situation.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's actually Connie Plank style.
And you have these two people, 80 years old, and they're offering, you're cool.
Eberhard Schöner was. Yes, you know, of course I knew him before I was meeting him. Of course I knew that he was buying the first Moog synthesizer in Germany. It was just an honor to meet this guy. And when we got there, it turned out to be the greatest experience, one of the greatest experiences that we had as a band.
And what's really crazy is that the neighbor house of this studio was the house where Popol Vuh was living.
Because they had the second synthesizer.
They had the synthesizer because of Eberhard, because he was the first one. And also, he also told us that the guys from Tangerine Dream were coming to him and
checking out the Moog.
And they all bought it because of him, you know? And he was the first one. And Giorgio Moroder was lending it from him to produce and all this stuff. And now it's the synthesizers in the museum.
Mm-hmm. I saw that. Yeah.
And we were honored to play. Yes, it was really,
it was amazing when we were listening back to the files we were recording with the old Moog. You can feel that a lot of music was made on this instrument.
I'm not so keen on Moog synthesizers like Mario, but when I played with it in the studio at Stadelberg, I made some sounds out of it. It was like, it sounds like it could be like now and played in Berghain just right now. It's not vintage at all.
I remember this. Scene exactly. We set up the Moog on the floor. We said we want to do a real crowd rock week. You know, we want to do a crowd rock week. And so Toby was wiggling on the Moog. And I remember it exactly. I came to the studio and it sounded like the most modern drum loop you can
drum
imagine.
Drum and bass,
you know? And we said, and Gerhard, our technician was there. We really said the people in the 60s and 70s just weren't ready for these sounds because it was like back in the future.
When you play a XAP or a
Jupiter or
something like that, you always have this vintage sound. Yes. But with a Moog from 69, you can make, and you just make your music. It's so modern. It's not vintage at all.
It's like, I
don't know why.
You know, since really, this point in time, I'm working nearly exclusively with the 3P because I found out that Bob Moog, how he intended this instrument to be. And I found out that it's a machine able to produce any kind of sound on a timestamp. It's like you have currency saved on magnetic tape. And this machine should be able to emulate all kinds of waveforms occurring on the tape. So if you see a machine like this, there are many tricks Bob Moog incorporated in this instrument, like which is actually like from technicians, you know, from old tricks of old sound engineers. This is really amazing. I really can't get into detail, but it's unbelievable what Bob Moog invented with this instrument.
Yeah,
I think.
I've actually been to the Moog Museum in Asheville, North Carolina.
All right.
And you see the original the prototype for the first Moog that he worked on.
From which year is it? The prototype?
67.
Yeah, so around late 60s at some point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's all with his tools next to it. They have it kind of set up like it's on his desk in the museum. So you could kind of see what it looked like when he was working on it.
Eberhard showed us all the Super 8 films where when he bought the synthesizer. So Bob Moog was like 35.
They have videotape from 1969, yeah?
Yes, where they're
very, very interesting.
Yeah. So like small town and Moog music. Yeah, they're pretty funny.
Is the Moog on all of the album, most of the album?
There are some overdubs made with the new Moog 3P we got in 2019. The new Moog, it took some time that it sounded really good. Like some burn in time with the circuits, you know.
Right.
It's like a new violin needs to be played.
Which is fantastic. Yeah, going back to what you were saying about like the JXP and things like that, you definitely don't have that feeling with that kind of gear.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. When you had that week with the Moog, did you go in with songs or did playing with it inspire new songs?
Yeah. It actually was 2 weeks, and after
no, it was more.
After that, we went again.
The Moog was here from time to time.
So it was not just 1 week.
No, maybe.
it was many times
over a period of like two and a half years. It was like Eberhard was talking to us, and he said, "Look, guys, the Moog is supposed to go to the German Museum next May." And he tried to stretch this time a little for us. And it turned out that he stretched it for 1.5 years, that we could use the synthesizer from time to time, always like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Then it was located in our studio. We didn't tell anybody.
Yeah. But for them, it was really nice. You have to imagine they're great people. They have done a lot of things, and they saw young people like us. For them, we are young. and they saw, okay, they are really keen on this instrument. Oh, that's nice. We help them. They are making art. They're really arty people. They love art. They love it when something is happening. And so they saw it. Our energy and how we are doing music with this instrument, and they liked us, yeah. Very
nice.
They liked
us, very, very, very great people. But his son told me he is really, really happy that the old Moog was rising up again once more before it got to the museum. And I'm really, really happy that we made like 3/4 of the whole album with old Moog.
How did it affect the songs? Did it inspire new songs, or did you just mainly apply it to songs you'd written previously?
We got to the studio with two songs we wanted to record. We knew we did not have that much time. So we need to set up. I need to get close to the Moog. It's different, a little bit different. We took our time to be creative and not record what we know that works. So we were also experimenting with the instrument a lot. Because we wanted to find out what's possible.
Yeah, of course, you have to.
Yeah, I mean,
and I think
it was running 24 hours.
I would think there'd be a danger of just experimenting and not actually working, because it'd be so tempting to just sit there and
the Moog changed the sound of some songs.
Very much.
Some melodies were still there, there, but every instrument inspires you. That's the interesting thing to work with instruments. Yeah, it's if it's a Döpfer or it's a Moog, you always get to, or a good sequencer, you come to a new idea. I think the Moog of Eberhard really changed the song. It changed the sound, everything.
Actually, I was on Super Bowls. What is the big synth fair in Berlin? I was asked by Moog to play to try out the Moog 55, which was the later model. I didn't feel so much difference to the newer models because of the oscillators. And Toby was it that he got in touch with Gerhard Meyerhofer, who's the owner and the founder of Synthwerk, which is the company that copies Moog exactly. And he and Toby said to me, hey, listen to these old oscillators, to these 901 oscillators, the real first oscillators of Moog. And I was like, oh, man, this really sounds good.
This is really the thing.
This is really the thing.
If you hear and, some 901.
And Toby was actually right. And I was like, okay. And so we got the opportunity to play with the old Moog, and it has 10 901 oscillators, and this really changed the sound. This really changed our sound. So this combination of the old, really vintage synthesizer gear, this is what changed my way of working.
Now that you don't have access to the Moog, the classic Moog anymore, is your sound continue to be changed by the experience, like going forward?
Yes. Definitely. When we were on the Stadelberg at Eberhard Schöner's house, I developed a new way of composing for synthesizer just because of the Moog. Because I only had one filter and I had three oscillator banks. So there is one song on the album, which is called Nocturne. This is only made by one single filter. It sounds like four voices, but it's only the four oscillator banks. Let's say the three oscillator banks plus the additive oscillator of the Moog sent to one filter. And it's amazing what's possible with this old instrument. This really changed everything for me in way of composing.
You were comparing it to like to getting a violin warmed up earlier. And it's almost like someone having like a really amazing violin and a special violin, and they don't have access to it anymore, but it changes their playing moving forward.
Yeah, it was like this. When we got the new Moog, I ordered the new 3P in November of 2018, and we got it in February 2019. The first serious recording I made was in autumn. So it took nearly half a year. The machine was running 24/7 to get it in shape, to get the capacitors and everything work properly together.
Right.
And you really can hear it, and the more you can feel it when you're playing it with the instrument. We take it on tour from time to time, the Moog, the new one. And now to answer your question, I would not change anymore. I feel that the old Moog is in the museum, and this is really a big honor for Eberhard, that his synthesizer will be shown in 200 years in the German museum, and his heritage will carry on. And I'm really, really happy with my Moog. It's set up really, really good by a lot of technicians, and it runs 24/7. And there's no need for us to change.